is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting at all.
Stop. Yeah, stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and wrong. Here is Steve Gruber.
All right, my friends, welcome to the Steve Gruber Show on a Monday. Michigan lost something exceptional over the weekend. Something exceptional in my estimation. Jim Harrison, the novelist, the poet, the living legend, is now just a legend. Jim Harrison, who wrote Legends of the Fall and 35 other books, including poetry and fiction, and the story of Brown Dog, who, if you haven't read it, is a fascinating individual. To say the least, a fascinating individual. Jim Harrison died a poet's death with his pen in his hand at his home in Arizona, found by a friend, the pen still in his hand. The pen still in his hand, isn't that? Anyhow, I think Jim Harrison was one of the great writers, maybe the last of a breed. A man who lived hard, drank hard, wrote hard, and died quietly. One of Michigan's true treasures, Jim Harrison. All right, shifting gears to some Michigan politicians. Congressman Bill Heisinger was among a group of Republicans talking to Katie Couric over the weekend about Donald Trump and establishment Republicans, that is, and where we might be headed from here. Here's Bill Heisinger and some of his friends with Katie. Clip 6, go.
I want to ask you specifically about some of Donald Trump's positions to see how you feel about them. A ban on all Muslims who are not U.S. citizens from entering this country. I know that all of you do not agree with that.
Right.
Who does?
I agree that we should have a ban from those who come from hotspots that we can't verify who they are.
But he's saying all Muslims.
Yeah, I would disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I disagree with that.
Yeah, disagree.
Disagree.
Building a wall on the southern border and getting Mexico to pay for it.
First of all, you can't build a wall. That won't work. You've got waterway. I've been down to the border. I've seen it. There are other ways that we can monitor the border, and we should be doing that.
So you're opposed building a wall and asking Mexico to pay for it?
You, first of all, it can't be done. So.
Yeah, I reject the premise. I mean, Mexico has said they are not going to pay for anything that we do. We need to use physical wall. We need to use virtual wall as well. That's drones. That's cameras. Mm-hmm. It's all those things. That's how we have border integrity. That's really what we
agreed
need.
With, Bill.
Yep, border security, whether that's a wall or any other form.
Mass deportations of all undocumented immigrants.
It's not feasible.
Making Israel pay for defense aid from the United States.
Again, I don't think that's feasible. To completely send Israel off on its own, we do about $3 billion a year.
Okay, so guys, with all due respect, you just told me four of his, or at least three of his primary policy positions. But bring it on. I'll support Donald Trump.
We believe in making America great again. No, but I think what it is, though, even Ronald Reagan didn't have everybody agreeing with him. All right, and he's kind of held up as this vaunted. I'm a student of history. Go look at vote records. All right, Ronald Reagan, especially in his second term, was getting vilified by a number of the conservatives. Why? Because he did a straight out amnesty. Right. All right. So there is room for disagreement with a president within my own party.
Mm-hmm. And you hear that as far as the wall goes. Just imagine, if you will, how cute it would be, how much you would enjoy if it actually happened, that whether it's a wall per se all the way down, and there are rivers and waterways and other, you know, natural barriers to contend with, but if a wall of some sort was put into place and Mexico did pay for it, wouldn't that just kind of make you smile? Admit it. if our border was secured, and those that have been abusing it the most ended up footing the bill because of the criminal activity, the drug running, the running across the border illegally, all of that stuff came to a stop. That'd be awesome. Okay, so Katie Couric also talked to Bill Huizing, a straight-up one-on-one, Congressman Bill Huizing, a regular guest on this program. Katie Couric, I'm surprised she's still doing anything, but apparently she is. And one of the things she was doing was talking to Bill Huizing directly. Clip 7, go.
What do you think the establishment in both parties has come to mean?
Well, I think it's fascinating to me that, you know, Ted Cruz, of all people, is getting labeled establishment now. You know, it's like, I'm sorry, when did this happen? Yeah, it's
why shouldn't he be?
Because I don't think he, certainly he wouldn't accept that that label, but nor would Marco Rubio, a guy who ran against, quote unquote, the establishment, Charlie Crist, you know, for all of, well, at least the three of us, and Mimi came a little later, us coming in 2010. You saw that visceral reaction from the country that said, okay, wait a minute, we need somebody to put the brakes on this administration and the agenda that they're putting forward. And I always tell this story. I had a guy, I was on the door, knocking on the doors when I was running into my primary. And I had been a state legislator in the area in Michigan. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, I know you, I've watched you, your work in Lansing. I like what you've done. And he goes, I'm going to vote for you one time. And then after that, I figure you're probably just part of the problem. So I'm going to vote for you one time. And it's like, okay, before I've even cast a vote, I've lost you as a potential voter. And so, I think it just shows that frustration. They're not sure exactly even themselves what establishment is or means, but it's like status quo, or they feel like there's any kind of status quo.
Career politics.
I can answer that.
Throw the bumps out.
I can pick me. Pick me. I can establish. Establishment would be the people that have brought us close to $20 trillion in debt. Establishment would be the people that seem to continue to line their own pockets in Congress and their own pet projects at home at the expense of the American people. Establishment would be those that don't read the Trans-Pacific Partnership and vote either for it or against it without even knowing what is in it. Establishment would be those that supported Obamacare blindly and still cling to Obamacare even though it is punishing American citizens financially and when it comes to health care. Establishment would be those that are blind to the real needs of Americans while being adherents to their own political parties, whether Republican or Democrat, I care not. That's what establishment is, that puts the good of the party over the good of the people that put them in office. And it happens to Republicans and Democrats on both sides. Establishment would be those that allow the government to grow, even though that's not what we, many of us, want. It's not why we sent Republicans to Congress. Establishment are those that just seem blind and tone deaf and unable to figure out what's going on out here in the real world on a regular basis. That's what establishment is. And Congressman Huizing, when he comes back next time, I'll be sure to explain it to him in person. I'm good that way. I'm happy to take care of him. It is Monday here on the program, 14 after. It's the Steve Gruber Show. You can find out more at stevegruber.com, or you can find the podcast and the Listen Live button and so much more. stevegruber.com. When you need extra resources, we'll be right back.
Delivering Michigan common sense with a big dose of truth and honesty.
Welcome back to it. As you well know, been a lot of conversation over the last few days about this proposal put forth. This proposal put forth by the State Board of Education concerning how to deal with students who believe they are transgendered or might need to use alternative restrooms or locker rooms and so on and so forth. But the Michigan Department of Education and the State Board of Education now extending the deadline for comments from the public on guidance for school districts surrounding LGBTQ students by at least 30 days. They say that they want to be very thoughtful in this discussion, hear all of the input, clarify any misconceptions, so on and so forth. The fact of the matter is they found themselves in a firestorm of parents saying, now, wait a second. Because in large part, what this proposal did was eliminate parents from the discussion in many regards, and that just didn't fly with folks. Joining me now, State Senator Rick Jones. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Good morning.
So, okay, where are we with this discussion? Obviously, this was a this was a firestorm on social media and so forth, to say the least.
Yes, it's open for public comment, and many of the senators and reps will also be making comments to the school board. I think the majority feel in Michigan that parents should be involved in any decision on their children at school, whether it be holding them back because they're not reading at third grade level, or bathroom decisions. Certainly the parents ought to be well informed and help with the decision.
See, this is what I think is the most disturbing part of this whole proposal, is the fact that, you know, little Johnny could go to school, as far as his parents know, could, you know, say that he is gender confused or gender whatever, and believes he's a little girl, and therefore the teachers could treat him that way, and then send him back home as little Johnny again and never tell the parents. I mean, what in the world is going through the minds of alleged educators who think that they have that kind of power? I mean, at that point, you are literally less than a step away from your children not belonging to you anymore, but belonging to the state.
Well, absolutely. You know, and all this nonsense about taking away parental rights is just that. Parents must have the ability to raise their children appropriately, certainly not abuse their children physically or something, and feed them correctly. I mean, we must make sure the parents are doing that, but they should have the right to make a decision on where their children go to school and make sure their children are learning and growing as we all want them to.
So how did we get to a place where the State Board of Education believes that they have, you know, and whether it's this issue or anything else, this one happens to be a hot-button issue. But why would they think that they have the right? And because the thing that's really disturbing about this, it's K through 12. A kid could come to school as a first grader, say, well, I feel like somebody else, and I want to use that bathroom over there. And the State Board of Education suggests that that's okay, and we shouldn't tell the parents. How do you end up at a place like that?
Well, when you allow your board to be so liberal that they come up with nutty ideas.
How do we fix it? I mean, seriously, how do you? This is maddening. It's appalling. It's reprehensible. It's inexcusable. How do we stop it? How do we change it?
If they come up with something that is so outrageous, it offends the Michigan citizens, I'm sure that the legislature will respond appropriately.
Well, they did do that. They have offended Michigan residents.
Well, if they haven't come out with their final decision, if they come out with their final decision, I predict legislation will pass at a rocket's pace. It will shoot right through the legislature and be on the governor's desk.
Now, when you say that, though, you look at is something similar just passed in the state of North Carolina, and now big events are saying, you know, the city of San Francisco is banning travel to the state of North Carolina, as an example. Other big events like the Super Bowl may sidestep the state of Georgia if the state of Georgia moves through with legislation like this, or other things that have been getting a lot of attention, of course, being the Religious Liberty or Religious Freedom Acts that would allow Christians to, you know, conduct their business without being, you know, maligned. You tell me, where do we go from here?
Well, we just keep fighting the fight. You know, we have a big decision in November, and that decision could decide, do you want the village to raise your kids, or do you want to raise your kids? Because, yeah. You know, it's quite obvious that parents need to be involved in their children's lives and raise their kids, not Hillary's legions.
Yeah. So, all right. So, what is your bottom line on it, real quickly, before we run, about restroom use and locker room use and things of that nature?
Well, my bottom line: if their children are involved, the schools need to go to the parents, let them make the decision, And if a child truly is transgendered, then give them a single bathroom. I would never, ever, ever put a boy in a girl's bathroom, put a girl in a boy's bathroom. That makes no sense. Will only lead to trouble.
Senator Rick Jones, always a pleasure, and thank you for your latest on this. I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Have a great day.
There you have it. Senator Rick Jones checking in today on this whole proposal. It's been extended for at least a month. We'll see where it ends up. But he says if the school board offends Michigan citizens, I believe they did that successfully. I believe that has already happened. I believe they have offended quite well a whole host of people. That is why you had this incredible pushback. You had this incredible pushback from people all over the state. The buzz on social media was incredible, to say the least. But for now, we'll see where it goes. Public comment is extended for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender questioning school children by the State Board of Education. People like President John Austin ought to be held accountable on this one, on the Steve Gruber Show.
Keeping you in touch with Michigan and the world.
All right, welcome back to it. So I have a good friend, a lot of friends that are in agriculture, but one friend who's outspoken on GMOs, genetically modified organisms, and so forth. And a new study that I posted here recently said that there is no danger, and science is coming to the point that there is no danger with genetically modified organisms. I defy you, in fact, to find a genetically modified organism that they can prove is dangerous, and moreover, find corn in this country that isn't, or wheat, or rice. This friend of mine, by the way, who is a farmer here in southern Michigan, has told me that in recent years, the production per acre of grain crops has gone up many fold just since 1980. Why? Because of GMOs. Because they are resistant to drought. They are resistant to insects and other pests. They make it possible to feed the world. And yet some do-gooders just don't get it. Our next guest, Aaron Bakst, studies and writes about agriculture subsidies, property rights, environmental policy, food labeling, related issues at the Heritage Foundation in agricultural policy. Darren, welcome back.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So, all right, GMOs, you know, and the other boogeyman, of course, is Monsanto, but that's for another day, I suppose. But, you know, I've read a lot because I see this on social media that GMOs are this and GMOs are that. But, you know, I was raised in the shadow of Michigan State University, an agricultural land-grant college that, along with other schools in the Big Ten and in the Midwest and around the country, including places like Texas A&M, for example, that's where they spend their time creating better food sources, more pest-resistant plants, and so on and so forth. And somehow, somewhere, the green do-gooders have decided this is their next target and this is a problem. Let's bring some truth to it, Darren.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a compliment to call many of these people that are opposing it to be do-gooders. It's quite honestly, I mean, look, I understand some people like to see labeling of the genetically engineered food, but, you know, there's a reason why there's no evidence that there being any harm, and that's because, you know, genetic engineering is simply a process. It's not necessarily, it's not the actual makeup of the corn or the cotton or the soybeans that we're talking about. In fact, if the genetic engineering actually changes any material aspect of the corn, then that already has to be labeled. So, you know, if there's some type of allergen as part of the corn related to the genetic engineering, that has to be labeled. But the process itself shouldn't be labeled because there's no evidence at all that there's any harm associated with the process of it.
So why would they go to all this trouble to, you know, to make it sound like we have to make people aware of this, because they have this, I don't get this notion that somehow a GMO, which, again, is it even possible to find corn in this nation, whether a sweet corn in the field along by a farm stand or field corn that feeds livestock and so forth? Can you even find non-genetically modified corn left anywhere?
There's not much. You know, it's important, like, for thousands of years we've kind of genetically modified food, but it's been the last 20 to 30 years that we've kind of used this process called genetic engineering, which is just more precise. I mean, if you looked at corn from hundreds of years ago, it's nothing like what we think of now. It's just completely different. And it's about 93-94% of corn is genetically modified in the U.S., and at least genetically engineered.
So if I buy corn flakes, I mean, let's be honest. If I buy corn flakes from Kellogg's, a great Michigan company, by the way, the fact of the matter is, it's a GMO food, has been since I've been alive. And since I've been alive, I might add, Darren, just in my lifetime alone, the life expectancy of Americans has gone up 18%. 18%. And yet we're consuming corn flakes and, you know, and all these other products that are clearly improved by science, better living through science. I mean, when did Michigan State University and Ohio State and the University of Minnesota and these other land-grant colleges, agricultural schools in their origins and their basis, and still today, Michigan State, one of the leading agricultural schools in the world, they basically became the target. I mean, because that's what you're talking about. The research that these scientists have done my entire life and beyond are the targets here.
Yeah, and look, there's just been a lot of scare tactics out there, and it's just taken on a life of its own, this attack on GMOs. You know, it's one thing to say, look, I want to know what's in my food. So guess what? What happens is companies do respond to that. If people want to know whether or not there's foods, you know, non-GMO or GMO, the companies will respond accordingly. And there are ways to find out. Organic, there's non-GMO labels. The problem here from a policy perspective is that a lot of the people that want to know this information, they don't simply want, you know, companies kind of voluntarily disclose it. They want companies to mandatorily, I know you'd use the power of government to force companies to disclose whether or not it's been genetically modified. And my question is, why do you need the government to do that when you already have companies and all these different labels telling you when food is not genetically modified? It makes no sense to me. You're not really getting any information. And it's like having, you know, being looking for gluten-free food and then demanding, you know what, I want all other food that's not gluten-free to say non-gluten-free. That makes no sense.
Yeah, here's, isn't it, come on, do you laugh like I do when you're walking through, you know, a store and here's, a steak? Gluten-free. No kidding. Yeah, the meat is gluten-free. Don't you think it should be? or I saw a package of almonds someplace that was gluten-free. No kidding. Almonds are gluten-free. I would expect that. It's gluten-free is like just a hook to get more money out of people's pockets, from what I can tell.
Well, you know, for a lot of that, that's true. There are some people that do need the gluten-free. Yeah, but the market responds. The companies will indicate that something's gluten-free. There are people that, you know, do have a problem with gluten. But the point is that the people that are concerned with gluten don't then expect every product that happens to not be gluten-free to say that. In other words, the labeling of mandatory labeling of GMOs is simply a way to create kind of a negative connotation with GMOs. It's really kind of an anti-GMO effort. It's not an effort to really find out whether a food has GMOs or doesn't have GMOs, because you can already find that out through these voluntary efforts by companies that participate, you know, develop organic products, and or voluntarily disclosing not, you know, this non-GMO label that exists. So, you know, it's really kind of an attack on GMOs itself, not just the labeling, but just not having GMOs at all, just getting it out of the food supply.
And in fact, when I come back after the break, stick with me, Darren, for just a moment, okay. Because when I come back after the break, we're going to talk about one of those attacks on GMOs in general that had no basis in reality and no basis in common sense, no foundation for what it was. I'll explain that when I come back. We'll continue our conversation about GMOs and Should you be concerned or not? My feeling is no. I trust the people at Michigan State. I trust the people at Iowa and Minnesota. I do. These are scientists. Their families eat from the same tables we do, for God's sake. 41 after on the Steve Gruber Show.
The Steve Gruber Show. American values with Midwestern common sense.
All right. Welcome back to it. 45 after. One of the most sanctimonious companies out there when it comes to GMOs and such and free range this and that, of course, is Chipotle, the sanctimonious company. Of course, they've poisoned hundreds of people with bad food over the last couple of years. Hundreds sickened by botulism and salmonella. This is, you know, common foodborne illness they couldn't even deal with. But Chipotle, you know, said they were going to go GMO-free here not that long ago. Forced to add disclaimers now to all of its GMO stuff because the meat and cheese in its burritos and bowls most likely come from cows and pigs that ate genetically modified feed. In fact, it's almost for certain. Furthermore, they couldn't find enough pork and beef to fill their free-range grass-fed nonsense either. They're sanctimonious, but they're also hypocrites. They have 1,900 restaurants complaining about restaurants. Whole Foods similarly explains on its website that about 88% of corn grown in the U.S. is genetically modified, they say. 95% of sugar beets, 93% of canola, 94% of soybeans. So even the sanctimonious folks at Whole Foods realize that this whole nonsense about GMOs is ridiculous. And let me ask you something. We're on the line with Darren Baxt here from the Heritage Foundation. Let me ask you this, Darren. Do you think it really matters to a kid in sub-Saharan Africa if he's eating a bowl of rice and beans or whatever? Does he care if it's a GMO, or is he just happy there's food in his bowl?
Yeah, I'm going to have to say he's happy with the food in the bowl. And yeah. I think that kind of gets lost on people that, you know, in this attack on GMOs.
Well, I always appreciate self-serving liberals traveling coast to coast in Lear jets complaining about global warming and eating at fancy restaurants while talking about the plight of the poor and eating their steak while decrying, you know, large farms and then, you know, covering it up with rice pudding at the end that is a genetically modified organism while decrying it all. Limousine liberals are an amusing group, are they not?
In a way, the sad thing is this kind of movement is, you know, kind of disregards, it's likely to drive up prices here domestically for food.
No, it certainly will.
Hurt the poor. Yeah, that'll hurt the poor. You know, the poor have a disproportionate amount of their income goes to food, so it hurts them more. And then, you know, genetic engineering shows so much promise for so many different things and to help feed the world. That's really one of the biggest reasons why I'm so concerned about this issue. Is because to the extent that we undermine genetic engineering, we undermine our ability to feed the world. And that's a real serious concern. And, you know, there are entire industries, like in Hawaii, for example, the rainbow papaya, the whole papaya industry was about to fall apart not that long ago. And through genetic engineering, they actually were able to develop a kind of a resistant papaya to this ring spot virus that existed there, and it actually helped to save the industry. So, I mean, that's the kind of potential that genetic engineering has. So,
well, you know, and again, here's the thing. As I was saying at the top of this conversation, my good friend, who is a farmer in southern Michigan, is a crop farmer, not a livestock farmer, says his yields today, if there's a drought in Michigan today, that his yields will be many times what they were during ideal conditions in the 1980s. His yield will be dramatically higher today in a drought year than they would have been with ideal, perfect conditions in 1980 or 1985. And yet people try to dismiss that. I might remind people that the folks that are behind things like Earth Day told us that, you know, people would be dying. 250 million people a year would be dying from famine, and there was no way we could feed ourselves. Well, actually, again, thank you to agricultural universities like Michigan State and others. Thank you to these universities because they have provided the basis for which not only can we create more food, we've created a surplus of food, and we can feed just about everybody. Now, our distribution systems may have some problems, But there is plenty of food to go around if we can get it to the people that need it because of GMOs and other scientifically based solutions.
Yeah, and the truth is we would want some of these other countries to be able to kind of start actually feeding themselves and to be able to do so through genetic engineering. But the problem is some of these scare tactics are filtering around throughout the world, and it's, you know, it's blocking people from potentially getting food and being able to grow food on their own that can feed them in the future. I mean, we constantly hear people on the left constantly push towards this, that a lack of resources and the overpopulation, and it's kind of creepy, to be honest. And now we have an important solution to feeding the world as we go forward, and as population grows in the decades ahead. Yet we want to kind of shoot ourselves in the foot and not use this technology.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give people a couple of examples of things that are going on. By the way, Canada has emerged as a leader worldwide in genetically modified foods. For example, Canada has come up with a non-browning apple. They turn the gene off that makes apples discolor when they're exposed to the air. Isn't that great? Massachusetts-based Aqua Bounty received approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration last fall for the world's first genetically modified fish. The salmon is a farm-raised Atlantic salmon imbued with growth hormone genes from a Chinook and an eel-like creature called an ocean pout. Change allows it to grow much more quickly, a potential boon for aquaculture. Now, we can debate whether aquaculture is good or bad, but you get the point that we can create more food, which is probably in the end, Darren, with a world with more than 7 billion occupants, probably a good idea. I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, I mean, there's also something called golden rice, which is there's a lack of vitamin D for a lot of people all over the world, and that leads to, for example, blindness and all kinds of problems. And what they've been able to do is to infuse some of this rice. This rice is a common staple throughout the world. They fuse the rice with the vitamin D,
mm-hmm.
and it helps to kind of solve some of those problems. But
there you go.
Again, there'll be obstacles for this.
Darren, thank you so much. I've got to run, my friend. I greatly appreciate Derek Baxt from the Heritage Foundation. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Now, let's just take a moment and think about how much love there is in the world and just kind of hold each other for a moment. Can we just share some love here on the Steve Gruber Show?
God's great big family and the truth. You know love is all we need.